Money FM 89.3, best of weekends.
The closure of the Chinese consulate in Houston and the closure of the American consulate in Chengdu is yet again another moment in U.S. Sino relations that is putting pressure on those two relationships. Joining us now for our international news review is Steve Okun, the senior advisor at McClarty Associates and former Clinton administration official, and Randy Phillips, managing partner for Asia for the Mintz Group. Randy spent some 28 years with the CIA, primarily serving in Asia, posts from Kuala Lumpur, Jakarta, Tokyo, and twice in Beijing. Gentlemen, welcome to Weekend Mornings.
Oh, thank
Good morning,
you.
GBC.
Randy Phillips, why don't I start with you, since the diplomatic side is really the one that has taken front and center over these past a week and a half or 2 weeks. In broad strokes, the closure of both of these consulates, from your perspective, having worked closely with consulates before, many of them, how important a moment is this in the relationship between the U.S. and China?
Now, Glenn, I'd say that it is a very important moment in that it is escalating, you know, fairly significantly what it has been a deteriorating bilateral relationship over the last, definitely this year, but arguably back through the trade war. Making this move to close consulates, you know, really kind of ups the ante a bit, you know, beyond, you know, the tech war kind of issues and clamping down on some of the issues related to filings, company issuances on various stock markets. And so I think what it is, it's a real shot across the bow on both sides. And I wish I could say that I thought otherwise, but I don't think this is going to be the last that we're going to see. I think that this is the first move here, and I think that we're probably going to see more.
Randy, we had seen toward the end of last year, let's say the third quarter or so of last year, the trade war was raging, but there were some steps that were being taken to back it off a little bit and to come up with some, I'll put it in quotes, solutions to that. And then all of a sudden, in just these recent weeks now, the Trump administration has really gone after Beijing in terms of spying and some of these other issues, hence the closure of the consulate. Mm-hmm. Where and why did we see this shift from we're trying to work it out, our relationship, to taking the harder line? Many are saying that this is just kind of a political move by the Trump administration to maybe get some political capital going here at a tough time for him. But from your perspective, why did we see that shift?
Well, you know, I think the sort of the easy way to look at this is that it's somehow Trump in the run-up to an election wanting to show that he's being even more tough with China, which there's a certain amount of truth to that. Mm-hmm. But I think the real story here is that this has been building for quite some time. And this is actually one of the issues that is truly bipartisan in Washington, really wanting to push back on some egregious practices by China over a number of years. And I'd start with cyber. I mean, the cyber intrusions and the overall value of the theft that has happened to the United States, and frankly, this isn't just a U.S. story. This is happening to many of our friends and allies across the world. It's happening in Singapore. A truly aggressive effort that is out there, despite the fact that there was an agreement between Xi Jinping and President Obama in 2015 in the Rose Garden that they would dial that back. Now, there's been an accumulating frustration. And so I think what you're seeing here in this closure is really a, you know, a step up in the pushback to say, we're not going to take this anymore. And you could argue over whether or not it was the right step to take, but it really is showing that there is a desire to want to push back in a very meaningful way to try to change some behavior.
And we're speaking with Randy Phillips, managing partner for Asia for the Mintz Group, a 28-year veteran with the CIA across Asia, and also Steve Okun, senior advisor at McClarty Associates. Steve, we'll get to you in just a moment. One more question to you first, Randy. The Chinese consulate in Houston is being called the epicenter, the nerve center of the Chinese spying network in the U.S. by U.S. officials. How true do you think that is based on what you've seen and what you know? And just how much, let's put it again in quotes, damage was being done by that particular building in that particular city?
You know, the one thing that's interesting about the way China has traditionally gone about its intelligence collection has been more out of official installations and inside. So it's not that each of the consulates or the embassy in Washington is this hotbed intelligence activity. I mean, they certainly have, you know, their fair share of this. More of what how they traditionally collect is actually done outside through the private sector and students and activities outside of officialdom. But the official facilities have a role in coordinating some of that, but actually even more so in the influence operations. The United Front Department and what they do to try to influence politicians and influence companies and go after Chinese nationals that are in the U.S. to toe the line for what the Chinese Communist Party wants to do. That is a very important function of all the official locations. Houston is the first consulate in the U.S., outside, obviously, the embassy in Washington. It covers a pretty wide area. It's very important. I would argue that the gem, really, or the two gems that of the constellation of consulates for China are really in San Francisco and New York. So one could argue that while it's not unimportant that Houston was shut down, you could have gone after San Francisco or New York and perhaps had an even greater effect.
So perhaps this was a measured approach, if we can put it that way, toward if one was going to be closed, this was
exactly.
A less important one to close than some of the other ones.
Exactly.
Yeah. Steve Okun, let's move over to you. This, of course, has raised a lot of, you know, on the U.S. side, a lot of plaudits like, hey, finally somebody's doing something about this. But there are also some economic implications. And now just within the last 24, 48 hours, the U.S. is talking about closing down TikTok in the U.S., among other companies to try to hedge and get away from any kind of Chinese influence or interference. What is the business community looking at in terms of the U.S. response and back and forth with Beijing?
Well, I think what you see happening now is that they're, the realists, political realists in the Trump administration realize that he is likely to lose in November. So what they are doing is taking the hardest line possible in taking actions against China, shutting down the consulate, you know, banning apps, doing more in terms of sanctions on individuals, because that is going to limit the policy choices that Joe Biden would have as a president if he were to win. So they are really trying to leave their mark on U.S.-China relations in a way that is going to tie the next president's hands if Biden were to win. And for the business community, that means that there is going to be the need to plan for more tensions. There are real consequences when the Chinese shut down the consulate in Chengdu. That is the opening to the West for the U.S. business community. It's the opening to the West of soft power for the United States to build those types of people-to-people relations that are, you know, last or current still officially, but last Consul General there, Jim Mullinax, was so great at doing. So there's real harm to the business community that could have been done in a different way and had been done in a different way by the Trump administration.
We've seen, and Steve, you just spoke about this recently on the Inside Asia podcast with Steve Stein about the four major speeches that were given by government officials in the Trump administration recently, all hitting out at China. And like you say, really setting the bar for future actions and the future relationship, at least in the near term, with Beijing, and how difficult that would make that for, as you mentioned, a Biden administration if it comes into power. But it will also be difficult for a Trump administration. If the Trump administration continues on for another 4 years, they've got a lot of economic headwinds that they have to face. And China is a huge part of the marketplace for American businesses. Aren't they doing themselves some potential damage as well?
Well, of course they are. But remember, the sole goal of President Trump right now is to win re-election in November. There used to be balance within the Trump administration between what they called the globalists, people like, you know, Steve Mnuchin, the Secretary of Transportation, Wilbur Ross to a degree at Commerce, Lighthizer to a degree at USTR, who said, it's reality. We have to trade with China. They're the soon-to-be largest economy in the world, and we need them to help us grow economically. And then you had on the other side the China hawks, led by, you know, Secretary Pompeo at State, Peter Navarro within the White House, the Attorney General, who have said, we have to get tough on China. We have to take action. They are our, you know, literally that we're in a life and death battle between tyranny and democracy, which is, you know, kind of how Secretary Pompeo put it. And they are ascendant right now because the economy is so bad, it's not going to get better between now and Election Day, that the political calculus is, let's be as hard as we can on China. That is good to help Donald Trump's reelection strategy. After the election, if we have to go back, we'll go back, because President Trump is very transactional, and he'll be transactional about this too.
We're speaking with Steve Okun, senior advisor at McClarty Associates, and Randy Phillips, managing partner for Asia for the Mintz Group. And Randy, your almost three decades in the CIA, I'm sure, has given you a lot of insight to this. And I'm not sure exactly how deep you can pull the curtain back for us. But when we look at that Chengdu consulate that was closed, the U.S. Property there, it was important, from my understanding, not only for collecting information, but also for businesses there understanding and messaging the Chinese people in that area. That is, of course, a kind of stepping off point for Tibet and other areas. And that presence has been there for over 30 years, some 35 years.
35 years.
Yeah. So that particular consulate, the fact that the Chinese chose that one, you just spoke about why perhaps the U.S. chose, you know, Houston instead of New York or San Francisco. But why do you think they chose that one, and how much is the U.S. hindered now going forward by not having that facility open in Chengdu?
Well, no, that's a great question, Glenn. I'd say the first thing of why choose Chengdu, that was, a measured response on the part of China, in that it's not the most important. If they shut down Shanghai or even Guangzhou, that would have been a much more significant hit in terms of just overall interaction. So I think that makes sense. And plus, they've never really liked the Chengdu consulate in the sense, because it does have, you know, each consulate has a geographic responsibility, and Chengdu has Tibet. And that's something that never really, you know, liked to see when coming out of that consulate. You know, their responsibility was try to get into Tibet. China has always pretty consistently tried to keep people out of Tibet, and you know that is what it is. I think probably the most important thing here to remember is, you know, we're comparing apples and oranges here. Hmm. The ability of Chinese diplomats in Houston or any other consulate in the U.S. to access U.S. politicians, businesses, policymakers of all sorts is much more accessible compared to what U.S. diplomats have in China. And that, frankly, that goes for any other country's diplomats. My friends in the Singapore Foreign Ministry have said the exact same thing, along with other colleagues. Mm-hmm. I mean, you are much more restricted in who you could actually meet with, who will take a meeting, how you can travel, compared to what China has been afforded in the U.S. So if you look at that just from a accessibility of doing your job, of how you can influence, be able to reach out to people, I think it's actually the Chinese consulate is going to, and the Chinese overall diplomacy in the U.S. is going to take a bigger hit in a sense than the U.S. will in this. I agree with Steve what he had to say, that it's unfortunate. Jim Mullenix has done a great job, along with previous colleagues there, of doing their best to get the message out, to work people-to-people exchanges. But it's always been with one hand tied behind your back. And I think we just have to keep that in mind.
Yeah, it's no probably surprise or secret to people listening, even a novice like myself, that statecraft is happening all over the world, right, with many different governments, not just the U.S. and China. And the focus has been on Chinese spying against foreign companies, getting their IP, the companies that are based in China, using it, turning around, making their own products, etc. But what about the U.S.? What about the U.S. role in this? Is the U.S. guilty of doing its own, you know, IP acquisition, let's put it that way, you know, on Chinese soil? Are we doing the same thing that the Chinese are doing, but maybe the Chinese are just doing it on a larger scale or better at it?
Well, I mean, I have to be kind of nuanced on this.
Of course. I would expect.
I don't think that we're at that point of having to, you know, in pursuit of IP per se, but that day may be coming closer than we all think, because there are, you know, a number of very strong and, you know, world-class Chinese companies in advanced technologies that
sure
are now going to feel the brunt of people coming after them, the way that U.S. and other countries' advanced technologies have been pursued by China. And that's the way the world has been since as long as I think history books have been written. So I have no doubt about that. I think that, you know, the scale of what China has done. I mean, I'll just give you one brief anecdote on this. one of the few things that people often ask me during my career at the agency, you know, hey, is the working in the agency anything like what Hollywood puts out there? And I'd say, you know, there's actually only, you know, a couple things that maybe come close. And that is, you know, in our national security agency, there's a, you know, interagency kind of war room, in a sense, of looking at cyber intrusions in corporate America. And if you look at, compare just the numbers and the frequency of attacks on critical infrastructure, and China is something like 10x beyond the next leading competitor. And it has been that way for a long time. Just the scale and the brazenness of how China has pursued this, despite promises to scale it back, is, I think, you know, that is absolutely the background of what the politics are doing and what the policy is doing right now in China.
Yeah,
I want to make one point that Randy made. I agree completely that we are, you know, have one hand tied behind our back when we're in China from a diplomatic perspective, sometimes even from a business perspective, than the Chinese have in the U.S. But being in there is so important, even with one hand tied behind our back, showing what U.S. business does, showing what the U.S. is like, showing how we work with our employees, work with our partners, how we work in the community. That is what is helping the United States in terms of trying to show the people within China that it's in China's interest to change. We, as the United States, are not going to change China on our own. It has to come from within as well. And it is sometimes worth having an unlevel playing field, because that is going to help us in the long run more so than it is going to help China. And that's why these tit for tat and basing it on reciprocity is going to damage us, I think, in the long term.
And Steve, you know, from the business perspective, American companies have been operating in China for decades, knowing that they were at risk of losing IP, of losing manufacturing processes and that sort of thing. And they have done it willingly and knowingly, knowing that, first of all, it's access to that market for their companies, but also, you know, making cheaper products for the domestic market in North America and Europe and elsewhere, products that people want at the prices that people want to pay. So, you know, doesn't the U.S. business community have some culpability in the ongoing process of you know, IP or processes being stolen, if that's happening in certain mm-hmm. cases? Aren't they culpable in this as well?
I'm going to push back on you on 2 points and then let Randy go. I mean,
sure.
I think, first of all, China is not an option. China is not an option for business. China is essential. It's going to be the world's largest market. It's going to be the world's largest economy. You have to be in there. You just cannot cede that to anyone else. Second, businesses weren't just in China to make products and then manufacture them out. That might have been true 20 years ago, 10 mm-hmm. years ago. Now you want to be in there to serve the Chinese domestic market. And what did fail the U.S. business, and what we missed, I'll say, speaking as the U.S. business community writ large, is that we thought China was going to follow the international rules. They were going to come into the WTO and live up to the letter and the spirit of those commitments, and they didn't do so. And so the business community and the government, you know, getting back to Randy's original point, came back. We now have a bipartisan consensus in the United States that our approach to China needed to change and needed to be nuanced over time. And just because Trump says something doesn't make it wrong. How he is executing it, I think a lot of us disagree with. But but there is a change that needed to take place. But the business community didn't go in saying, well, we're going to sell our souls so we could get access to cheap Chinese labor to manufacture. And that hasn't been happening for a decade or more.
Randy Phillips, what's your take on that?
No, I agree with Steve on that. I've spent a lot of time, vice chairman of the American Chamber of Commerce in China, out of Beijing. And so we, for the longest time, we were probably the best cheerleader, in a sense, for China, particularly right after WTO ascension and into probably 2012, 13, 14, of saying, hey, you know, this interaction is good for everybody. China's going to come along. We're going to be fine. And then it became really clear, particularly in the Xi Jinping era, that, you know what, that's not happening. Not only is it not happening, it's regressing and getting worse. And even at the end of the Obama administration, we were advocating in Washington that, hey, something's got to change in China because this just isn't working. And, you know, and certainly on the end of the beginning of the Trump administration, the clear message is, yes, you got to be in China. You got to be able to sell to that market. You got to be able to, you know, manufacture in that market. But I think what businesses have definitely taken taking a note of here is that, you know, you've got supply chain issues of not being so dependent on China. You've got, if you're in the market to sell to China, you're pretty much staying in and maybe even increasing your investment. If you're there to manufacture and export, you've been heading out the door for a while now for cost reasons and politics. If you're somebody like Apple and you're trying to do both, you're caught between a rock and a hard place, and people are trying to figure out how to nuance that. And that's what we're seeing on the ground.
Gentlemen, a fascinating discussion and clearly no end in sight to this topic or the views of it. And we would certainly hope to have you guys on again in the coming months as things evolve. Special thanks to Randy Phillips, Managing Partner for Asia for the Mintz Group, and Steve Okun, Senior Advisor, McLarty Associate, our regular contributor. Thanks for your time today, gentlemen.
Thank you, Glenn.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg. Or download the SBH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.